I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Alan Hague Brown joins me again. In a new book, he takes us to when he was a teenager in the 1960s. He hadn't quite finished high school, but found himself married into a fishing family. The Asu family had been fishing for generations, and since Alan was married to Herb and Mitzi Asu's daughter Vicky, he found himself working on a fishing boat. It's often tough work, and Alan recounts it all in Raincoast Chronicles 25, Mama Schla Goes Fishing. He's got marvelous stories that provide insight as to what it's like to make a living, as the Asus did, on the water. You get a sense of what it's like navigating British Columbia's west coast, and Herb did that without radar. The fishery resource as it was, and the challenges of life on a fishing boat in such close quarters. It really is a loving look at this formative time in Alan's life, as he'd go on to work as an educator and then editor of the West Coast Fisherman and founding West Coast Mariner and the West Coast Logger. The book comes alive with Alan's stories of adventure and the occasional misadventure aboard the Asu boat. We also get a sense of the times, the relations that Indigenous peoples had with the commercial fishing industry, as well as how Alan found his way into this family being a white guy. The book also comes alive with the photographs of Alan's former wife, Vicky Asu Robbins. Taken aboard and from the boat, you see what life was like on the coast over 50 years ago now. Alan Hague Brown seined salmon and herring until 1973 and served for 11 years as coordinator of Indigenous education in the Cariboo Chilcotin. A noted international marine journalist, Alan's award-winning books for Harbor Publishing, which publishes Raincoast Chronicles 25, include Fishing for a Living, The Fraser River, and Still Fishing, which he was on this program with in 2010. He divides his time between Bangkok, Thailand, and New Westminster, B.C., where he joined me from last week. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Alan Hague Brown. Mr. Hague Brown, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Thanks for joining us. Most of this book takes place in the 1960s. You were just out of high school, and I understand you hadn't even graduated high school yet. Is that right?
No, I had not graduated high school. I was a terrible student, and it was time for me to get out of high school and go and do something. So married my high school sweetheart, and her father took pity on me and gave me a job on the fish boat.
Yeah, and so you were married, and this was your father-in-law's boat. How long had the family fished by the time you came along?
Oh, forever. Yeah. They're indigenous Lehuto Nation people, but in the commercial Western style, my father-in-law would have been the third generation skipper. His father, Dan Asu, uh-huh, was a skipper, and Chief Billy Asu, very famous leader in the BC coast, was one of the first same boat skippers on the coast.
How did the say larger commercial fishery, how did they regard an indigenous family's fishing, say?
It's kind of interesting. The fishery was very ethnic. So what I observed was that indigenous people tended to fish their home waters. Now, we went all over the whole coast, and so did others, mm-hmm, but our preference was home waters, which was a, I don't know, 10, 15-mile stretch of Johnson Straits, north of, between Campbell River and Kelsey Bay. But if you took a Norwegian skippers, mm-hmm, they came here, and once they left the port of Vancouver, it was all new water to them. So it was easy for them to explore all the way. And in those days, you could still fish Bering Sea for halibut. And the Norwegians came from that North Atlantic tradition, so they became the longliners, the top longliners in fishing Bering Sea, whereas the Croatian skippers, who came from the more sheltered Adriatic Sea, they became top seine skippers. So Japanese, with their background inshore fishery, tended to get into the gill netting, mm-hmm, and also there was legal racial prejudice on what ethnic group was allowed to fish. So, and that changed decade by decade also.
Yeah, that's another thing I found interesting in the book, is you talk about racism. that you encounter. And it must have been an eye-opener for a white kid to see that and see how it was sort of structured and how it was legal in a number of ways. I mean, in one part of the book, you talk about buying and selling booze. I mean, these are things that I don't know, at that age, I would find surprising. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I can't say it was surprising because I grew up in Kelmer River.
Sure.
So I had Indigenous friends at school, and my father was the local magistrate, and he was very opposed to the restrictive laws on alcohol because he said they criminalized young people. He would get a young 20-year-old guy in court for being in possession of a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah.
And that was the law. So then he had a reputation of letting people off, but he couldn't. You know, the law was written down. So I had heard about that. And we also had people, everybody's doing these land declarations now when they introduce a talk. And I always think of Daisy Price, who used to sit at my father's dinner table. She was a great big grandmother kind of woman that looked after a bunch of kids. And she would say, "Hey, Brown, you're on Indian land."
Yeah.
And that was like in the 1950s. So I was aware of it.
Yeah.
However, you're right. The detailed use of it by the legal corporate system in maintaining separation of Indigenous people from the best access was very clearly there.
Yeah. There are wonderful lessons in the book that you learn from Herb, especially Herb and his wife Mitzi. I guess as you write later in the book, Mitzi was like a second mother to you, wasn't she?
Yes, and she lived sometime after my own mother, so I continued to visit her until she died just a few years ago.
Yeah. I found Herb such an interesting character because he's such a great teacher, not just to you, but a lot of other people. And the way that he imparts his wisdom, it's unique, isn't it?
It is. And again, I later went into working in Indigenous education, and it was an important lesson for me to understand that there are different methods of learning. And Herbie's method of learning and teaching was observation. So you could try it out. And I didn't really learn all that well in that manner. I didn't become a skipper.
Mm-hmm.
But his slow patience of look and listen. And one time, I remember numerous times, he would say to me, "What do you think? Is it time to let go?" Well, he didn't have to ask me if it was okay to set, but it was a way of teaching. And I would look, and I'd see the kelp heads heading one way on the beach, and I'd say, "Yeah, it looks like the tide's changed. Maybe it's okay." And then he'd show me a little line on the surface and say, "Maybe not quite ready yet." And that was it. End of lesson.
Yeah.
So that patient observation was really informative to me.
And he was like that, not just to you, but his kids too, right? His sons?
Yes, yeah. And his sons eventually just, went and took control. They go and take the boat and run it around, and his youngest son is still running the family boat.
Yeah. As a skipper, though, again, this is where I found Herb fascinating. This is all before radar and all that, right?
Yes. We got radar while I was fishing. So I don't remember exactly, 63, 64, somewhere in there probably.
Uh-huh. But Herb and his dad had been going up and down the coast without radar and all that, right?
Without radar, and basically without charts. We found a chart on the boat one time. It was underneath the skipper's mattress. And I had worked on coastal freighters a little bit, and I worked a six-on, six-off watch, and, you know, we kept the logbook every point we passed and all that kind of stuff, whereas Herbie, I'd be on the wheel for a few hours, and he'd get up, and he'd blink once out the window and say, "Oh, you came here, or you came this way." the more I think of it, and this is really more in my recent thinking, his ancestors traveled by canoe right up into the early 1900s. So when they traveled by canoe, they would travel along the beach because you want to take advantage of every back eddy you can and all the currents because you're paddling, right? And so they would navigate along the beach. So when we got in fog, it was not a comfortable place for him. He wanted to know the beach. So in one story I tell in the book, I got us lost in the fog. It had set down, and I called him, and he went looking for the beach, because once he found the beach, he knew where he was. So it was a different way of looking at the coast. I don't know if that would be true for some of the West Coast people that went whaling offshore or stuff like that. They may have had others. This is a very particular, very specific knowledge. Yeah. And we went, you know, up north, Wales Channel, all over the coast. But he had learned those by sight from people.
How big a boat was it that you worked on in those days?
The first boat was the San Jose. It was a bigger boat, 75, 77 feet, I think, exactly. It had been probably built for pilchard by a Japanese on the West Coast in 1927.
Yeah.
The second boat, the Departure Bay 3, which was the longer-term boat, it was around 55, 57 feet. We have different measurements for boats because the British system measures between perpendiculars as opposed to overall, so... But I usually say 57 foot.
Yeah.
But it was a narrow boat too, because it was built with low horsepower engines, and you couldn't just push water around. You had to glide through it. Yeah. It was a beautiful, beautiful hull.
And how much fish could say that the Departure Bay 3? How much fish could that hold?
We never loaded it with salmon because we delivered every day. We didn't have any ice or refrigeration.
I see.
And if it had been loaded with herring, I wasn't on it for herring fishing, it probably would have held 20, 24 tons, something like that.
Wow. Huh. Yeah.
Whereas the San Jose that we did fish herring on, it could carry 64 tons.
Wow.
Which was relatively small even in its day. Other boats carried upwards of 100 tons and more than that today.
I guess you get to know someone well in such close quarters when you're working on a boat like that, right?
You do. It's very much a family boat, and there's all kinds of little stresses and squabbles and fights. Mind you, my two brothers-in-law were teenagers, right? Well, they were going through all of their work and stuff out and fighting with each other and fighting with her dad and not wanting to get up in the morning or whatever, right? So you're party to all of that.
Yeah. Herb had a great way. I mean, he'd hire people, and sometimes they wouldn't be great workers. Like, I'm thinking of the guy who had a gun.
Yeah.
Whose name I forgot now. That guy in particular was kind of lazy, wasn't he?
He was a con artist, really. He was taking advantage of his friend and everybody else. So lazy in that sense. But Herb was not a big organizer thinker. So sometimes he didn't line up crew before the season or something. At the last minute, we'd be trying to hire a guy that got off the dock, right? And Herb's joy was being on the boat, feeling all the tide and the current through the soles of his feet. It was entirely integral to his mind, and that's what he did. And he also gave his kids and his son-in-law and his whole family work. So sometimes we ended up with some people that weren't really cut out to be fishermen, to put it mildly.
Yeah. There's money to be made, obviously, in fishing. At the same time, as you write in the book, a lot of these operations like Herb, as you write in the book, you know, he had to take on a lot of debt with, you know, getting new boats, say, or things like that.
Yep.
The system, as I read that part in the book, really goes up against the sort of family operation. I mean, I hate to say that you have to be corporate, I guess, and even in those days to really make a long-lasting success of it, right?
Well, there was a thing. The Nelson brothers were Norwegian immigrant brothers who ran a very good fishing company in its time, because what they did is they matched the man to the boat. Mm. So if they had an aggressive Croatian skipper like Louis Persich, for example, they would lend Louis the money to build a new boat. And two or three years later, Louis would have that boat paid for because he was a very aggressive fisherman. And so then they would be afraid that one of the other companies might raid him. So they would go to him and say, Louis, you need a bigger boat. And they'd lend the money to buy another boat. And they would keep him involved with the company in that way. Herb, they wanted Herb because Herb knew the tide in Area 13 of the Johnson Straits. And he could make sets with a cotton seine and under 100 horsepower engine, mm-hmm. and a Manila lines, so that if you didn't know what you were doing, things would break and you'd get hooked up. So an immigrant skipper maybe couldn't know that right away because he wasn't from here. Herb had that intimate knowledge that went right back to people canoeing, paddling a canoe through those same back eddies that we were fishing. So different types of fishermen for different types of boats. And the old fishing companies knew how to manage that. When the economists, the government kind of handed over to the economists with a guy called Peter Pierce, who said, we got too many boats chasing too few fish.
Yeah.
And all the public thought that meant, oh, we're killing too many fish.
Sure.
What it really meant is, if I was an efficiency expert trying to make a factory, I could make more modern, more powerful boats that anybody could fish, and we wouldn't need all of these little boats. And so that came in. The companies then transferred the debt to the banks. Mm. And by the 80s, people were going bankrupt when they hit 18% interest rates, and the whole understanding of that era was really gone.
So back to your time there and working on the boat. I mean, working on the water can be tough, and physically, and not just physically demanding, but risky too, not to mention the smells. There's one part in the book where you write about discovering gravel. After all these years spending so much time on the water, do you still need gravel?
That's a good question. I still sometimes take it when I'm traveling and I know we're coming into a rough patch, just as a precaution. I also think that with age, seasickness becomes less of a concern.
Mm.
However, when I was fishing, we fished a lot of sheltered waters. And so when we went up north, we crossed the Sound and places like that, it wasn't the experience that you read of people who say, well, I got sick for 2 days and then it got better. I was never 2 days straight in rough weather.
Oh, I see.
I'd be, you know, in Hecate Strait, I guess we'd be out there for 8 or 10 hours or 12 hours. But and so that was the main place I used it. Yeah. I still carry it in my travel kit, because if I'm writing a story on a boat in Thailand or someplace, I don't want to embarrass myself and freak people out by puking over the side.
I mentioned how physically demanding it was. You write near the beginning of the book about how delicious the meals were, and how memories of food, you know, are so strong. I mean, smells even, they're vivid still. You all ate well. But because I guess the work is physically demanding, you didn't gain any weight. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Well, of course, you're young too, you know. But
sure.
No, I when I got on the boat, I was 18. I wasn't even fully grown, really, in a way. You know, you develop your shoulders and your muscles, and it was a delight. And everybody I meet that fished when they were young says, oh, those were the best times of my life.
Yeah.
But they say it very much in the way that other people say the university years were the best years of my life. You know, being young and cocky and able to do anything, those are always good years.
Yeah. And as you write in the book, I mean, these years were so formative to you.
Yeah.
They really did inform the work that you eventually did all the years later, right?
Absolutely, right to today. I spent the morning scanning slides of teak tugboats from 2001.
Yeah, by the way, in this book, you know, there are wonderful photos that are, you know, that are throughout the text. Your former wife, Vicky, I guess she took a lot of those photos. Is that right?
She did, and that was a major thing. I had bought a decent little secondhand 35mm camera a year or so before I got married.
Uh-huh.
Vicky took that up, and she has had and continues to have a wonderful eye in photography, so that she has a good natural eye, and she works at developing it and making it better. And that, not very many people have a good competent photographer documenting their daily work in the 1960s, because Vicky came out cooking for her mother, like her mom would take time off or whatever, and Vicky would be on the boat. So those are a bonus in a way. They're a bonus that makes the book possible.
Absolutely, yeah. They're beautiful photographs in the book.
Yeah.
So at that age, were you already a pretty good shot? Were you a pretty good photographer?
Not as good as Vicky.
Yeah.
No, I took a picture and it was okay because I was something spectacular I was taking a picture of. When Vicky and I went back to the school, we lived at Clay's Wharf on Granville Island.
Mm.
I was a caretaker.
Yeah.
And we had a very good photographer friend, Stanley Triggs, who would come, and we would get our 20 exposures back from the local guy, and Stan would come, and he'd take the 20 pictures, he'd put them in two piles. He said, these are good, these are not so good. Vicky invariably had 9 out of 10 in the good pile.
Yeah,
she was... She was and is. I've been conversing with her a lot as I've been doing this, and to get permission and stuff like that. Unfortunately, she's going through eye operations right now, so she has a copy of the book, but she can't read it yet. So.
Mm. Now you eventually took up photography. I mean, I understand in recent years you had a book of shots from New West, right?
Yes. What happened was that when I became a freelance writer, there isn't enough money in the business to hire a photographer to go with you. So I had been taking pictures all my life, but I started to pay a lot more attention to it. And with mentorship of Brian Gavin, a guy that I hired at West Coast Publishing, but now is in New Orleans, and he's one of the top marine photographers in North America. And Rick Blacklaws, who has done books with me and is a very competent methodical photographer, so those guys helped me, and I began to pay more attention to it and do more of it. And so now I'm pretty comfortable. I go out every day for a walk and take one picture. So we did the New Westminster book of street photography, and I did another book in Bangkok of my walks in Bangkok in the morning. So yeah, I like it.
How do you divide your year in terms of how much time you spend in New West and in Asia?
Well, it's funny. I learned the hard way. You have to be in British Columbia for 6 months of the year in order to maintain your driver's license and your medical coverage.
Mm.
So I didn't do that, and they took my license away or gave me a temporary one until I proved that I was here for 6 months. So now I've settled into... I used to use Bangkok as a base to travel for work into China and Southeast Asia. Now I'm slowed down. I'm 83, so I don't do as much. And so I spend the 6 months of the of the rainy season in Canada, summertime, yeah. and then 6 months of winter in Bangkok.
That's a probably a great way to break it down. You know,
yeah.
Weather-wise, you got the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah. I'm a laterally traveling snowbird, I guess you could say.
Yeah. What is it like, Alan, to look back as you do in the writing of this book and look back, say, to one's life, both professionally and personally? You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, this time that you spend, fishing was quite formative in the professional work that you eventually got to do. But, I mean, personally as well, it meant a lot. And so at this point in your life, when you look back at it all, I mean, do you enjoy that part of, say, looking back?
Absolutely. And the book really is a tribute and a testimony to the Asu family that were wonderful to me. And, you know, in more recent years, I think the last time would be 2010. I went out and spent a few days on the boat with Darryl, one of the sons.
Yeah.
And so my relationship with the family has been important all my life. And their patience with me and their teaching of me as a young man was central to me. And I very much view the book as an expression of appreciation for that.
There's some marvelous stories in it. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading this. And it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. I looked it up. We last talked, I guess it was 2010. We need to not take 15 years to talk.
Well, I guess I have to get in the mood of excitement to do it. And I'm not going out chasing on boats all over the place anymore. So I've got a little more time to sit and reflect too, so and do some writing.
Yeah, you got. I'm sure. Lots more stories, indeed.
Yeah.
It's nice to talk again. Congratulations on this book, and all the best.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Rain Coast Chronicles 25. Mama Schla Goes Fishing. It's published by Harbor. Its author, Alan Haig Brown, joined me on the line from New Westminster in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.